Hello and welcome back to CoronaCast.
Hi.
I'm Hannah Harris.
And I'm Tilly.
And I'm a GP in South London and Tilly's my daughter, who's an actor. And this is our podcast about all things Corona, from health advice to people's experiences and stories and interviews with experts.
In this episode, we are very excited to welcome Ish Aladi, who is an A&E doctor and an actor.
Yeah, so he's the perfect guest for our podcast.
We speak to him about his career in both theatre and medicine.
And hear how the pandemic has affected both of them for him.
Yep, and it was really great to talk to him.
He's such a great guy. We hope you enjoy it. Before that, my disclaimer, I'm a GP. I'm not a public health or infectious diseases expert. Opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
Cool.
And before the interview, we were just going to say a few words about the current sort of lockdown restrictions or lack of restrictions, because I kind of feel like we need to reinforce the message. I really feel like people are feeling like lockdown is over. There's a big party that I can hear a few houses down, and it's kind of concerning. Yeah, although it feels to some extent like coronavirus has gone away because cases have dropped so low, deaths have dropped so low, certainly in London. I think cases in the north are still fairly high, although I think they're dropping as well. We've heard today, though, that Weston-super-Mare Hospital has closed to any new admissions because there's such a high level of coronavirus down there for whatever reason. So the virus is still around, and I think we need to be really wary and cautious still.
It's been so crazy, this lockdown, and I think people are so eager for it to end that it can feel like it could be easy to clutch to straws and be like, nearly there, why don't we just do this thing and just do this thing? But you know, if we do that, then we might have a second peak and have to go back into lockdown even that was even more strict than this one. So
yeah, and for longer potentially with the possible second peak. It may be that that doesn't happen. We just don't know, and that's why it's really important to stick to the rules still.
It does feel more relaxed, like you can sort of feel it in the air, but people's lives really are still at stake.
And it feels like summer now. It's bank holiday Monday, everyone's out and about in the park. But yeah, you know, the social distancing with the 2 metres is still really important. You're meant to meet with one other person. I think people are meeting in bigger groups than that. But certainly, you know, big groups just are not a very good idea, even outside, where yeah. It's so well ventilated compared to inside. There's still a risk if you're around many other people. So just kind of wanted to reinforce that message, like I said. Because I think it is still important for people to stick to it while we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we need to get a better idea first.
Jonathan Round in our last episode was talking about how the virus might disappear in the end, but that doesn't mean it's disappeared already. Okay, so now on to our interview.
Over to Ish.
Okay, so I'm delighted to welcome to CoronaCast today Ish Aladi, who is an actor and an A&E doctor, and we can't wait to hear his story. Hi Ish, welcome to the show.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So, first of all, can we just go back to the beginning and can you tell us how it came about that you wanted to be a doctor and an actor?
Well, I suppose like the first thing I really wanted to be was an actor, definitely. I was brought up by a mother who was entirely, you know, loved the golden age of Hollywood, you know, the movies of Gene Kelly, Ginger Rogers and things like that. And my grandfather also, her father also loved that stuff. And he was a doctor, my grandfather, and he also directed plays. He used to translate English plays into Tamil, and in South India where they lived, he used to put them on with the community actors and things. And so the love of theatre and medicine sort of comes from that side. My father also is a doctor, but also loves the arts. And I went to a sort of after school theatre school from about the age of 4 or 5, and I did like everything from ballet, jazz, tap, and to singing and acting.
For oh, so amazing! Long. So you were really brought up with it in your blood, as it were.
Yeah, very much like a performance was in there. My mum's a Bharatanatyam dancer and teacher, which is an Indian classical dance. Yeah, so I loved it, and I always loved performing. I always, you know, from the age of two, I knew where the Singing in the Rain video was, and I'd put it in and dance on the windowsill in my nappy and things like this, according to my mother. So,
so there was no stopping you, basically.
There was no stopping me, no, absolutely happen. No. Showbiz was there the whole time.
Okay, and then so you kind of made that clear very early on that that's what you wanted to do. And then, so where did the medicine come into it all?
Well, my father's a doctor. Both my grandfathers were doctors, and a lot of people in my family, typical of an Indian family, I suppose, were doctors. And my dad was one of these people who sort of annoyingly loved his job. And he would come home and at the dinner table would just talk about it nonstop. He never sort of said, you should do this, but he'd just say, oh, I'm having the best time. I had this wonderful patient. I had this wonderful day. And
really passionate.
Very passionate, very infectious to be around. My sister is a doctor. She's a consultant pediatrician, in fact. And she always knew she wanted to be a doctor. So I was, you know, half our family in Stockport were very medical leaning. But I, as an Asian person, like growing up in the, you know, like early 90s and things like that, there weren't that very many people that looked like me on television.
No, of course not. Things have really changed in the last 30 years.
Yeah, right. I remember when I was 16, I think it was, like, I'm watching Goodness Gracious Me, you know, the wonderful comedy show. And then Meera Sayal, Sanjeev Bhaskar, these people who I've, you know, had the joy to work with recently, but like and when I was 16, they were the only people I'd ever seen really on TV doing a major sort of cultural thing.
That was groundbreaking, wasn't it?
Absolutely groundbreaking, and it was such a wonderful thing to see. But then if they were the only ones and they were already doing that, I still didn't see where my place was in the industry.
No, so, because it was actually really unusual.
Yeah, exactly. Very unusual.
Yeah, but must have been inspiring in a way as well for you.
Oh, absolutely. And they've paved the way for so many of us, and I'm forever grateful to them. But it meant that I didn't really see going into drama as a thing for me. And I love people. I love science. I like asking questions and helping people. And when you're surrounded by people who want to be doctors, it sort of was a default position, really. It was sort of like, what else would I do?
Yeah, it's funny. It really reminds me of my upbringing, bizarrely, because I had that same thing, very much brought up with music. It was more for me and the arts, but my parents were both vets, and I was really encouraged to go down more of an academic route, even though I was being brought up playing all these musical instruments. So studied music and then did medicine later on. So, yeah.
It's funny like how many medics or vets or things like that have grade eights in musical instruments or singing and things like that. I think everybody in that sort of end of things is so multifaceted.
Yeah, arts and science do really go, they do actually go together, even though you think of them as separate. And actually, it's really, really important to have both.
I think so too.
So, yeah, it means you must have had a very fulfilling life because you are, you're rocking it.
Well, thank you very much. It's not bad.
So you went to university, first of all, to study medicine then, didn't you?
That's right. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Was that kind of what you agreed with your parents?
Well, no, I mean, they just said, do a degree of some kind. Make sure you have some security so that you have a job you can, you know, to fall back on. And they suggested, you know, biochemistry or computer science, which at the time was what was booming. I just thought the idea of sitting in a lab was the last thing that I wanted to do. Not involving people in the slightest, really, like looking at a screen even. I couldn't bear the idea. So I ended up doing medicine.
So did you do lots of acting then when you were at university?
I did, yes. I arrived at university thinking resolutely I'm not going to do any theatre. I've got to concentrate on my degree and curb this addiction of mine. And then that lasted a week. And then I auditioned for West Side Story, which was the first show I did at university. And it was, I mean, and it changed my life. I met these amazing people, a lot of whom are now professional actors as well. And all running theatres even, like so many of them are directors as well. So it was a very magical time. And then I think I must have performed in about 15, 16 plays over the years I was there. But I produced and publicized and choreographed and did probably in total about 45 shows when I was there.
Wow, that's incredible. So,
yeah.
The addiction definitely didn't stop there, did it?
No. Somehow I passed my degree. Who knows how?
Yeah, that's incredible.
Do you mind me asking where you studied?
I went to Cambridge.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I graduated like 2008. Gosh, so long ago.
Wow. So yeah, Cambridge has a sort of long history of theatre and performance, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. There's, I mean, everyone from, I mean, directors like Sam Mendes, Nick Heitner, Richard Eyre, people who run the National Theatre, and, you know, and the people that were in my time were like Eddie Redmayne, Tom Hiddleston, Dan Stevens, that lot were a couple of years above me, and then...
Right.
James Norton, Max Bennett, people like that were sort of my year, and the in-betweeners. So lots of people.
Again, it shows how, you know, the meeting of academia and theatre and the arts, very much. Oh, amazing. So you finished at Cambridge. Indeed. And did you go and work as a doctor straight away? What happened there?
I did, yeah. I went, I was, so I did my first 2 years in London. After you finish your medical degree, you do what's known as your foundation programme. And that's get a feel for how to be a doctor in real life, right? So, as you know.
Yeah, get the practical experience under your
belt.
Pretty
much hit the ground running kind of time, right? And I did that in first, my first year was in Croydon, in the what was then known as the Mayday Hospital. I had a lovely time there. I thought it was wonderful. But the second year was when everybody sort of decides to... what speciality they might train in, or if they're going to move to Australia or something like that and do you know, take some time out. And that was when I applied to drama school.
Okay, so you just did those first 2 years. So what kind of course did you do?
I did the 2 year course at Lambda, which was sort of the 3 year course of the BA in acting, but like smushed up into 2 years, and which meant it was a really intense but brilliant time, and I've met some of the best friends of my life, you know, who I still Zoom every week now at the moment. So we have we have a lovely little film club going on at the moment. It's amazing what creative learning is in comparison to sort of scientific learning. It's such a different experience, and I think I benefited from having done the other one, my other degree first, definitely. But yeah, I just loved it. I just loved how fun and silly it was. And
yeah, I bet the opposite end of the spectrum, really.
You had to let go of everything as opposed to hold on to stuff, you know, and that's really fun and scary. Mm. Yeah.
And did you do any medicine in those 2 years?
Yes, yeah, because the rent had to be paid. So after 6 years of student loans, I don't think the government were going to necessarily give me any more money. So, which is fair enough. I completely understand that. And so I was working as an A&E doctor locum. It was like my temp job, you know.
Yeah, that's what lots of people do, don't they? After their first 2 years foundation training, they just locum around different A&Es and get more experience and have a bit more freedom for a bit.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe you found time to be an A&E doctor and do actor training. That's crazy.
I haven't slept in about 20 years. So.
That's the only way.
That's the only way.
Yeah. So once you finished and you had acting jobs, were you still having to sort of juggle?
Yeah. And that's the thing with acting is that you don't ever really know what you're going to get and how long it's going to last and what's going to happen as a result of having that job, you know. And that's both the beauty and the curse of it, really. And also, no one knows who I am. When you leave drama school, you know, and I wasn't a particularly bright young thing when I left because I was 29. So
haggard, no sleep.
Absolutely, exactly. Haggard, no sleep, cynical. But I was very lucky and I got, you know, work as soon as I'd left drama school. And then it was whenever I wasn't working, I was so glad to have this thing to, I mean, it sounds weird to call it a fallback, but it was my fallback, like, and an incredibly fulfilling one, really. It still is, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking, actually, like, lots of actors have the problem of kind of when they're not working, doing a job to kind of pay the bills and that's it. But you'd already kind of done the training to have this job that you also really enjoyed. So I guess in a way it was a blessing, a big blessing.
Yeah, you're right. It is a blessing. And I mean, sometimes it feels like, oh, I wish I could just do a mindless job as well, you know, and not have the stress of it that comes with, you know, being in an A&E sometimes, you know. I think it's it, for the people watching, for the things that you learn, for the perspective that it gives you on acting, because you can get, I'm sure you are already experiencing it, Tilly, but like, yeah. You know, you can get really stuck in wanting the best role and it being the most important thing in your life. And I think, you know, being able to step out of it every now and then is just, that's the best part of it, really. And just, you can get that release from it and realize there's more to life in both senses.
Yeah, you kind of get that dose of reality.
Yeah, exactly. And then going back into creativity after working in a more rigid environment is also just is freeing. And so it's a lovely balance.
That was actually what I was going to ask about, having the two things that you do, because often Tilly has been kind of given the advice that if you have a plan B, it means you'll never succeed at acting because you're not putting everything into it. But you've had these two things. What would you say to that?
I don't view my medicine nor my acting as mutually exclusive. I need them both to be able to get through and for the way I get through life. And I've struggled with it. Sometimes I think, oh, I'd just like to get rid of the medicine completely and I'd just concentrate on being an actor. And maybe that would make me better. And maybe it would show that I'm really driven and I really want this. But I think everybody has a day job. And I think, especially with what's going on now, everybody needs a day job, you know, and is really feeling it. And I don't think it's a distraction. I don't think it's an illustration of your drive. I think it's sensible. I think it's actually, if you really know that you want to be an actor, you need to know that you need to have a really good fallback. Exactly. It's actually taking your profession seriously. It's actually understanding the profession that you're going into is not secure. I've worked with actors who've played leads, who've been nominated for awards and things like that, and they'll go 9-10 months without any work.
Wow.
So I would say, like, yeah, there's more to life than just acting.
Yeah.
And you'll be a better actor if you experience the world.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. That's really great advice. That's a great take on it. And so I suppose this brings us on to the pandemic. So, and now I guess your medicine has really come into its own.
Yes.
And how's it been?
Well, it's been an interesting ride. Like, definitely roller coaster would be the appropriate term for it, I think. Because
Corona coaster.
Yeah, the Corona coaster, right? I mean, amazing. Like, it's the ride that nobody asked for.
Yeah.
But there is that thing of that, you know, I don't know if you've been on Oblivion in Alton Towers, but there's that bit just before you go down into the massive drop where you're just slowly climbing up the hill around lockdown, and just before it, it felt like we were going up to that peak. And I felt nauseated. I felt excited. I'm not going to lie. I mean, you're like, oh, what's this going to be? Mm. You know, because there's part of you as a doctor that, like, you know, enjoys that kind of stuff, you know, however sick and twisted that might sound. So there's that dread. There's that feeling of, but you also don't know what you're expecting. So if you've never been on Oblivion, you don't know what that's going to feel like. You don't know what that's going to be. You don't know how you're going to cope with it.
Mm.
That brings with it a certain tension and a certain discomfort that pervades everything you do. It pervades how you are before you go to work. Like, I find myself getting ready way earlier for work than I ever used to. I used to just basically running out the door. Now I'm just preparing everything, getting myself into a mentally available position, and then going to work and, you know, trying my best to relax into it. But it's less so now that we've been doing it now for a couple of months. Everyone seems to sort of know the lay of the land now.
Yeah, I guess you get accustomed to that feeling eventually. I remember that we all seem to be on this same pathway, actually everyone all over the world, where you started off like with denial and then it went into kind of fear and anxiety. Yes. You know, people were absolutely terrified and then came to terms with it, and that anxiety ebbed away a little bit, and people started to look at the practical things that they could do. And because there's, again, so much uncertainty with what's going to happen next, like, are we going to have a second peak? When's the second peak going to be? Is the virus going to just die out and go away? Like, there's all of these different views on what's going to happen. And we're still getting those ups and downs on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And you don't know even for yourself how you're going to be, whether you're going to suddenly become an agoraphobic, where the idea of a crowd right now is partly sort of exactly what I want to be in, but also I don't think I have enough PPE at home to be able to cope with it mentally.
Yeah, how will we cope with it? And I wondered, is there going to be an epidemic of agoraphobia?
I think there might be. I think people are already sort of very, you know, the anxiety even in a supermarket when somebody goes past you in the aisle is a sort of like, do you hold your breath? I don't know. you know, which side of the pavement are we all supposed to walk on now, you know?
It's a very strange time. Like, that the anxiety definitely hasn't gone. And you're working in Manchester now. Well, you live in Manchester, don't you, and work in an A&E there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And how is it at the moment? Have you seen, because I know there's been a lot of cases in the north recently. Aren't they on a plateau at the moment, or on their way up, on the way down, would you say?
I would say they were on their way down in our particular area, but we only had a couple of days ago two cases come in, and then we had a few more yesterday when I was working. But it really is no way near as much as it was probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And we're finding our ITUs are not as full. So I feel like Manchester may, the centre of Manchester, which is where I am, is probably going down. But I wouldn't say, I mean, judging by the graphs that everybody's looking at, I don't think that that's the case for other parts of the north. Certainly not further northwest from here, like in Cumbria. I think that's not what's happening there.
No, I guess the north is a big place. So how are things looking for you now then in terms of the acting? Obviously, we've talked a lot on the podcast about what's going on, you know, the plight of theatre at the moment, which is devastating.
Yes.
From your point of view, how are things looking?
Well, I'm bang in the middle of that black hole as everybody else is in the acting industry, I think, at the minute, where there wasn't anything coming up anyway, but there certainly isn't now. So that's nice, isn't it?
Thank goodness for your medicine at this point.
Well, this is it. At the minute, I couldn't be more grateful for the distraction and the just to be able to do something useful, feel useful is, it's getting me through the days. And I think, I mean, I'd love to be doing something creative to help as well. And I am. I mean, actually, I did an isolation play, which was written by a dear friend of mine who's also an actor and a doctor.
Oh, wow.
His name's Prasanna Purnaraja. He's a really great guy. And he's written a verbatim play based on the accounts of NHS workers. And it's part of a series of plays that are going to be on BBC Four next week. So that's from the 26th to the 28th of May, I think. So I'm in one of those, which is great. So sort of life meeting art meeting life thing going
on. Oh, wow. Life eating itself.
I'm playing an A&E doctor as well, which is, you know, classic casting.
Easy method for you there.
Really, yeah. I went in full deep cover on that one, actually. Yeah. But yeah, so that's one thing I did manage to do from the comfort of my living room.
So it's actually filmed, you're acting on camera. It's not a radio play.
Yeah, we filmed it via Zoom, essentially. I'm on my computer, and I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine they've done some technical wizardry to make it look great. And yes, it was very fun. I mean, the film that I'm in was based on Zoom conversations and things like that, so it works. It should work really well.
Great! It was enjoyable to do, was it?
Really fun, really, really fun. Yeah, and there's a great cast of people: as Rory Kinnear, Patterson Joseph, Anna Madeley.
Is it? Because I was like in my research for this interview. I saw that you had been sort of given a part in this Unprecedented. Is that what it is?
That's exactly what it's called. Yes,
okay. Unprecedented yeah. Theatre from the State of Isolation.
That's right. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what this is. Yeah, and the film I'm in is called Fear Fatigue.
Great. Okay, we'll look out for that. We'll post a link. Can't wait.
What has it been like working in A&E? Like, has it been majorly different or anything like that?
Well, yeah, it has been really different, actually. So the A&E I work at in North Manchester, when I was working there in January, we were sort of in the middle of the winter crisis. And we had, and this is just generally how it is, several patients on trolleys waiting to come into the triage area. So you can see about 15, 20 people on trolleys in corridors in A&E at its very worst. And we saw at the sort of when lockdown was put upon us, the admissions went down by, I think, nearly up to 70%. And so there were hardly any patients and coming in at all. And there were some days where I saw one patient in a whole shift.
Gosh, yeah, people just started staying away.
It's a very eerie thing. And it, a lot of the time it was just sort of, what's happening? Why is no one coming in? And because presumably people still were having accidents and people were still having heart attacks and various other things that weren't coronavirus. And we just weren't seeing that. And then about three, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the government did put out a statement saying, please do come in if you do have chest pain or abdominal pain or anything like that. And so people have started now coming back. But we're not still not seeing people in the numbers that we were seeing them in January or certainly in the middle of the winter crisis-y time.
No, really, it's been really quiet across the board, I think, in GP as well. I'm sure after all of this, when the sort of the excess deaths are kind of investigated in more detail, I guess some of those will be, you know, quite a proportion of them will be sort of non-COVID related.
Yes, I imagine so, which is so sad. And as much as like everybody at work would love a quiet day, we do actually go to work to help people. We do like it when people come in. It's like it gives us purpose for our job, you know.
Yeah, it's so, really unnerving when there's nobody there to be seen.
But then sometimes you'll then get seven ambulances coming in at once. So it's not like, you know, so then they're all sick and they all had COVID and they all were requiring oxygen or, you know, and half of them might have needed ITU, you know. So there were times when it would just come in little waves like that as well. So you're constantly on your toes. Like, you never knew what to expect. I mean, that's A&E and that's medicine in general, right?
So, yeah.
But with the global nature and the sort of what the rest of the world was telling us about what was going on and the stories of people bagging, ventilating patients in hotels, horror stories like that, or things, people in churches being ventilated because there weren't any beds, like what's happening in Italy, only added to sort of like, well, when is that going to happen?
Yeah.
And then the Nightingale Hospital opening, which I think in Manchester never had more than like 5 patients.
Yeah, I think the maximum in the one in London was sort of 19 or something like that.
So we were already, and I'm grateful that we were in a sort of like that provision was available.
Hospitals had capacity, but obviously a tragic number of deaths.
Oh gosh, absolutely. We can't possibly call this a success in any sense, in my opinion.
No, and although we try and steer clear from political
of course.
things on this podcast, this Dominic Cummings story has been breaking over the weekend.
Yes.
What is your view on that? Ish, would you mind sharing it?
I'm livid. I think what he did, it flies in the face of the rules that he was instrumental in creating.
Yeah, and ultimate hypocrisy, really.
Exactly, it's the ultimate hypocrisy. And as much as I struggle and I'm trying to find empathy with his actions, I really am struggling in the face of the tragedies and the sacrifices and the suffering that the rest of the country and many people have had to go through. It's unconscionable to have acted in that way and for him to have been supported in those actions.
Yeah, by the Prime Minister. I don't know where it's going to go from here, but that's a pretty major thing to do, is for the Prime Minister to support that behaviour.
In a national crisis, you want to be heard as a citizen. You want to have proactive, positive leadership. You want to feel empowered and emboldened and not passive and useless and discarded, which is what it feels like at the minute, I think. And I just don't understand adults who don't stand up and admit that they've made mistakes. Because if they have, it's not fine, but it's good to admit that you have.
Yeah, everybody makes mistakes.
I don't know what kind of message we're sending to children or to people when you can't stand up and, and admit to your mistakes and apologise for them.
Yeah, that's so true, Ish. Instead, you just lie and try and cover them up.
I initially thought maybe it's a legal thing, like by saying sorry, you're putting yourself up for litigation. But at the minute, after this Dominic Cummings thing, I mean, even the regulations they put in for us for isolation don't seem to stand up and now cannot surely be legally enforced.
No, it makes a mockery of all these fines that were handed out to people for breaking lockdown rules and things, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I think that everybody will be appealing those now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's just a complete mess. But also that ties into, what you were saying about owning up to your mistakes. There are important parallels with that in medicine, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Because I think in medicine, there's the God complex and all of that.
Oh,
and
yes,
I think doctors can find it really difficult to own up to their mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but it's so hard because the stakes are so high. And I get it. Like, I mean, I'm as defensive as the next person.
Yeah, we all are. We all want to be right.
Yeah, we all want to be right.
Don't want to get things wrong and make mistakes.
Exactly. You want to sort of seem like you're getting through things and you're doing okay. But it really does take a huge amount of humility to say, yeah, I've messed up here and I'm sorry. But I'm going to learn from it and move on, which, in medicine, to a certain extent, we're protected. But in recent years, there's even been, like, with the Bauer case, the pediatrician who she lost her job when she made a mistake and lost her registration. I mean, she was all reinstated after a massive legal battle and things. But
what a terrible thing to have to go through.
You know, and we all make mistakes.
Yeah, nobody's perfect. Doctors or prime ministers' advisors.
Certainly not them.
And I really think if Dominic Cummings had just immediately held his hands up and said, look, I'm really sorry, I panicked, I went north, I shouldn't have done that, it may have made the story go away.
Disappear a lot quicker. There wouldn't be anything to report on after that.
No.
Yes. Yeah.
Tilly, did you have anything else you wanted to ask Ish as your aspiring actor? Point of view,
I guess. Just, can you kind of see yourself having these two jobs and making them work for a long time?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I hope so, but I suppose because acting is my first love, I will never, I don't think, let go, truly, honestly, of the idea of that will be the only thing I earn my money from. But that, I think, as I said before, it feels like that's not really what being an actor is. Being an actor is having the day job and having the other things that you do and the writing and the collaborating with other people. So I think I will keep it because of that reason, and also because, especially now, like, I feel really vindicated in having stuck with it because I feel so useful. I get a lot of reward and esteem from helping people, and I think I'll keep it for that as well.
In a way, coronavirus has sort of underlined how important that side of your career is for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you need to feed the soul and feed the brain as well. Do you know what I mean? And I think my combination of things is a sort of, for me, a lucky sort of a balance of those two things, you know.
I'm slightly envious. I would love to have a career doing both.
Oh, do you know what? I mean, the one thing I would say is that the idea of doing anything for one thing for 45 years, like, I mean, I graduated from medical school at 25 and you're expected to retire, I think my generation is expected to retire at 69 or 70 or something. And the idea of doing anything for 45 years...
Yeah, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. I'm like, okay, no. There can't be one thing that I do that's that interesting. So there's still more stuff I want to do.
Yeah, I feel similar. Like, I think that's why I like acting, because there's so much variety in it. Whereas any other jobs I've done, I'm like, how do people do this day in, day out for years and years? I just couldn't do it.
Exactly. That's it. And that is the joy of being creative and creating new things. It will always be really interesting and meeting new people. And the joy of like acting is and creating stuff is that you work in these little families and you go from play to TV to radio and you meet all these amazing, wonderful people and you have these little bowls of fun creativity things. And you know, sometimes obviously it can be horrific as well, but generally my experiences have been nothing but positive. But I also look at my acting as sort of being in a relationship with my first love, who sort of will occasionally pick me up and drop me every now and then.
Yeah, you
know? And when we're together, it's so lovely and it's wonderful, and you know, and I'm wearing rose-tinted specs and the world's just a more beautiful place. And then when they dump me at the end of a job, then I'm in, you know, breakup horror.
That's really true.
Your fickle lover.
My very, very fickle lover. Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to pick back up on that you talked about, we're talking about Meera Syal and Sanjeev Bhaskar and them kind of being very inspiring for you when you were growing up. You said later on you got to work with them. Can you tell us what that was like?
I worked with Meera actually a couple of times. I was really very lucky. I haven't actually worked with Sanjeev, but Meera, I did Behind the Beautiful Forevers, which was based on a non-fiction book about the slums in Bombay. And it was adapted into a play by David Hare at the National. And I was in that, I think it was the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, and we did 90 something performances of this amazing play with a huge cast of people, and Meera was one of the leads. It was an ensemble production, but Meera had a really brilliant, fun part as a mother of one of the slum boys who gets wrongfully accused of a crime. And it's a fascinating real life look at, you know, of the slums next to an airport in Mumbai. And so that was the first thing I did, and then I got to work with her again a couple of years ago on a radio play. And yeah, she's wonderful. Aww. Hilarious and brilliant and very supportive. And yeah, it was really great to work with a group of Asian actors. There were 28 of us or something like that in that play.
Oh wow.
And it's the first sort of all Asian production I sort of done in terms of actors, and it was amazing to meet other people who were sort of doing the same thing that I was doing, having the same struggles that I was. And yeah, they're some of the best friends of my life, you know.
Oh, yeah. I bet. Yeah. And that really does show how far things have come in those, you know, from the time you were talking about growing up, where you thought it would be totally beyond your grasp.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you're in an all Asian cast at the National Theatre.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much for talking to us, Ish.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Such a lovely, lovely chat about all things medicine and acting. Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing your show. It's going to be on BBC4.
Next Friday, actually, is the one I'm on. Yeah, 10 p.m.
Great, and it's Unprecedented Theatre from the State of Isolation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you so much. Bye. Thank you so much to Ish for that interview. That was so, so inspiring. There were so many kind of statements there that I feel like I'll remember for a long time.
Yeah, he's got such a great take on life.
Something I really liked was kind of, especially from an actor's point of view, talking about like how plan A could have many parts. Honestly, like, it's so drilled into you, like, you can't have a plan B, you always have your plan A is acting, and don't have another thing to fall back on because you'll do that one, blah blah blah. Like, it really
is deviate.
An intense quite an intense piece of advice.
How committed are you, Tilly?
Yeah, that you're constantly given.
Yeah,
but to think that plan A could have more than one part is really nice. It's really made me think about what else would I be interested to do when I'm not acting. Like, I'll need a break at some point.
Yeah, so you don't want to be only doing one thing, like he was saying, and you have lots of other skills, so yeah, you can have lots of plan A's basically.
Yeah, my plan A can be a mind map.
Exactly. It was just amazing to hear about everything he's done and crammed in, you know. Juggling the two careers cannot have been an easy thing, but doing sort of 45 shows throughout his career at medical school,
doing Lambda and A&E, like having, I've got two friends that we spoke to doing drama school courses, like BAs, and then I did a foundation. They're so intense doing that and being an A&E doctor. It's weird because obviously I've got a big large insight into kind of the acting side of things.
Yeah,
and I've, yeah, but then with you, I've also, like, with mum, like, because I was very much around when she was training and becoming a doctor, I also feel like I really understand the stress of that. So I just put them together and I'm like, how did he do that?
Yeah, he's an amazing person. He's obviously got a lot of energy. He's really, really clever to be able to do all that at the same time and succeed.
And driven. Wow. Yeah.
But also so humble. It really was such a privilege to talk to him. Thank you, Ish. Yeah, and then just moving on to the news of the day about Dominic Cummings, because we talked about that in the interview. And since the interview this morning, we've had a press conference with Dominic Cummings this afternoon where he's explained his actions. But like we said in the interview, he really, if he just apologised, it would count for a lot. And I think it would really help the cause.
I think an apology is really the thing that's missing. The more I've kind of thought about it, the more I really think that's true. Like, even if it was the truth that he panicked and thought that they weren't going to be able to care for his child, and that's why he went to Durham, like, just say sorry for that, because there's a lot of people who would have been in the same position but didn't do that, and yeah, wouldn't be, and may have been fined for it or something like that. It's really kind of useful to just
hold your hands up sometimes. Yeah,
and say sorry, because like the public deserves an apology.
That actually shows a certain strength of character, I think.
100%.
And like we said, we're expected to do that in medicine, and I think it would really, really help here. There seems to be some implication that apologizing concedes guilt, but you know, maybe it does, but maybe that's what's needed here to be able to move on.
But I feel like people are trying to like make him look so guilty anyway. I think it's actually easy to sometimes forget about apologies and how powerful they are.
Yeah. Okay, and now finally onto the positive news.
So I wanted to give everyone an update, because obviously I spoke about my dad last week, and he's actually doing well. I guess I need to touch some wood around me or something, because I get scared every time I say it. But so far, and it's been a couple of weeks now, he hasn't seemed to get that ill. And you know, with this virus, we've seen it can go on for a while and then suddenly hit hard. But he seems to be past that. If I'm right in thinking, he seems to be past that bracket of where that tends to happen. Is that fair,
yeah,
to say, Mum?
Yeah, that's right. He's now sort of 3 weeks on, I think, or something. So,
oh, I said two or three.
Yeah, no, it's 3 weeks. Yeah, he's beyond the kind of danger zone, it looks like.
Yeah, I'm very, very thankful for that. So I just wanted to give that little update. He's doing good.
Is he back at work?
He is back at work.
Great.
He's doing well. So I hope that continues.
And the other piece of positive news is that we've come up with a name for our dog when we get it, which is going to be, don't know, but if Tilly doesn't get a place at drama school, that's, well, not just the sweetener, it's also, that'll be a good time to get one.
Yeah, because I'll be here.
So the name we've come up with,
drum roll please,
Disco,
because we love disco music and we wanted to pick a name that would like suit us and our vibe.
Yeah, and we think that does
a lot.
Yay!
And we think it would be so cute, and the more, like, you know, the more we think about it, the more we just think it's perfect, and yeah, it all looks so cute.
So when it happens, that is going to be the name of our dog, unless it doesn't look like a disco, and then we'll have to rethink.
No, but I really think it will. I just think we'll now look around the like, well, when we go and have a look at litters or whatever, we'll have to be like, we'll have to pick out the one that looks like disco.
So on that note, it's time to go.
Thank you so much for listening. And one more time, thank you so much to Ish for letting us interview him and saying such great things.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ish, again. And thank you for listening, yep, listeners.
We love our listeners. Thank you so much for always tuning in. It means so much.
It really does. And you can contact us by email to questions@coronacast.co.uk.
Or we're on Instagram and Twitter, and our name is @TheCoronaCast.
Thanks, everyone. Stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As we mentioned in the interview, I just wanted to give full details of the play that Ish is going to be in on TV this week. So the series is called Unprecedented, Plays from the State of Isolation. It's a series of 14 digital plays, newly commissioned, starring over 50 well-known UK actors. And 11 of the plays will be on BBC4 over 3 nights this week. They started last night, which was the 26th of May, and they finished tomorrow night, which is the 28th of May. And then all 14 plays will be available on BBC iPlayer. The play starring our wonderful guest, Ish Aladi, is called Fear Fatigue, and it's by Prasanna Puwanaraja. And that is going to be on BBC4 tomorrow night, Thursday, the 28th of May, around 10 p.m. You'll have to check your TV schedule for details. And we'll post details and links on our podcast description. We'll be tuning in, and I hope you do too. Thanks.
This podcast is produced by Pod and Chips for all your podcast needs.